picks from across the sports landscape. John, hope you're doing well.
Same to you, Jonathan. You, Paul. We're all trying to get through this, right?
We are. We are. Slowly but surely getting through it. And we'll get to some sports trying to return in a moment. We've been recapping our thoughts on The Last Dance. Jordan said that the one regret is not being able to run it back one more year for a seventh championship, that he would have returned on a one-year contract. Everyone else except for maybe Pippen would have likely been willing to do the same thing. And when you consider that 99 season was only 50 games because of the labor dispute in the league, what do you think when you think, what if they would have made a run for a seventh title?
Honestly, Jonathan, I'm not a big what-if guy. Jordan made a decision in 98 that he didn't want to come back to the Bulls. It doesn't matter why. I know a lot of people want to blame Jerry Krause, including Jordan, who hated Jerry Krause. And you say everybody but Pippen. Pippen would have been a hell of a loss if they were trying to win another championship. Jordan was another year older. Who knows? I mean, that's the whole thing about sports is we can what if on almost anything. And what if somebody had taken Tom Brady before the 199th pick in the draft? So honestly, I mean, we've discussed this the last couple of weeks. I didn't watch any of this documentary. What I am finding is two things. One, it's obvious that Jordan had final say over what did and did not go in to the documentary. He ends up sort of being the hero of every story from everything I've read and everything I've gathered. If you want to say, well, it came across that he was really a tough guy to play with, everybody knew that. I saw people today saying things about how fascinated they were to learn about the death of Steve Kerr's father, which I guess was part of last night. I wrote about that 32 years ago when I wrote A Season Inside, and I think most of this stuff I'm going secondhand here, but most of this stuff has just been kind of recycled and reproduced in a glitzy way so that people who didn't know would go, oh my goodness, wow, that's really fascinating. I'm not all that fascinated. I was fascinated by the Alex Smith documentary, The 1 Hour. That to me was a remarkable story of courage. This just didn't turn me on.
Well, the one point you make about Steve Kerr and his father and how he was killed, the one bit of info that I found interesting was Kerr and Jordan did not talk about their fathers, and both were killed. I found that maybe I shouldn't be surprised, but I think that one common goal, especially with the details that we learned throughout this piece about how Jordan was looking for the father figure and found one in one of his security guards. That they didn't discuss it at all, especially with Kerr and how open and honest and forthright he is.
Yeah, well, first of all, you may or may not know, Sports Illustrated wrote about Jordan and the security guard and the father figure thing, I don't know how many years ago, but a long time ago. And second of all, I did talk to Steve when I was writing my book One-on-One, which is 10 years ago, about his dad and Jordan's dad and the fact that they didn't really talk about it, but that when Jordan collapsed on the floor of the locker room after they won in 96, Steve felt as if he completely understood how Jordan felt having lost his father to a different kind of murder, but murder nonetheless.
It's a postscript to this whole thing, which obviously the documentary didn't get into. I'm wondering, 3 years after this whole thing was over and Jordan reemerged in Washington, if you could just kind of take us back to what that meant in the city of Washington, what the attention that brought. If you could recall for us exactly what his game was like at that stage, at the beginning of that.
Yeah, Paul, I do recall it very vividly. You know, he was initially going to hold his press conference to announce that he was coming back to play on 9/11. And it obviously had to be postponed. And when he did hold the press conference, it was jam-packed. And I remember I was there. I remember his line quite vividly. I have an itch and I want to scratch it. And of course, I've always been a believer that an athlete is entitled to define his own legacy. You hear people talk about that Willie Mays' legacy was somehow damaged by those 2 years he played for the Mets, and players coming back two, three, four, in the case of Jim Palmer, 5 years after they retired damages their legacies. It doesn't. Jordan's legacy wasn't damaged by playing for the Wizards. He's still Michael Jordan. I mean, the documentary, if nothing else, is proof of that. But he was much bigger. I mean, he was described by some as Fat Jordan. And what I always said about Jordan of the Wizards was if you didn't know it was Michael Jordan, you'd say, that guy's a good player. He was an all-star. He averaged, I think, about 20 points a game on a bad team. They didn't make the playoffs either year that he played. But he certainly made Abe Pollin a lot of money because every Wizards game was sold out for those two seasons, every home game. The Wizards never sold out before then and rarely sold out since then. So he made Abe Pollin, who was then the owner of the team, a lot of money. And that's why a lot of people, Jordan supporters, were very angry when Pollin fired him as the team's chief executive a year later. But they were separate issues. Jordan making money for the team as a player had nothing to do with the job he was doing, or really not doing, as the chief executive of the team. But he was a very good player in his Wizards incarnation. He just wasn't Michael Jordan.
Were there other teams interested in giving him the president title at the time, other than Washington?
I don't think so, Jonathan. I think that this was something that Ted Leonsis, who had already bought into the team as a minority owner and who had taken over ownership of the Capitals, I think it was his idea. They went to a guy named Arnie Heft, who still owned 10% of the Wizards, an old, old friend of Poland's. Not friend, but business associate, and bought out his 10% so they could give it to Jordan so he'd be a part owner of the team. But it was a strictly Washington thing at the time. And of course, when Jordan got fired, David Stern was the one who brought him back into the league as an owner in Charlotte, partly because he was Michael Jordan, partly because it was past time to make sure there were still minority owners. Bob Johnson, of course, who originally owned the Bobcats/Hornets, was the first African-American owner in the league, and then Jordan ended up with that team.
John, Zion Williamson, in a lawsuit with the agency Prime Marketing Sports after he left the company to sign with CAA, and for those catching up on the story, Williamson's deal with Prime Marketing Sports required him to remain with the company for 5 years. He signed with CAA less than a month after signing the agency deal with Prime Marketing Sports. And now they want Zion to admit he accepted money, benefits, and favors from Duke. Where does this fallout actually lead us to? Where are we headed with this?
Well, I think the lawsuit specifically says that, and it doesn't really matter, but that he allegedly received money from Nike and others in order to get him to go to Duke. And first of all, let's start with this. You're an agent. You sign a big-name client, and for whatever reason, I don't know the reason, he leaves in a month to go somewhere else, to go to CAA. So what do? You sue because you want to get your money back. You try to do everything you can to publicly embarrass the guy to make him look like the bad guy in this, and he may have been. I don't know. And in the meantime, you just throw everything out there. Mike Krzyzewski's been the coach of Duke for 40 years. His record is pretty much, pure. There was the one kid, Corey Maggette, who apparently was being paid by an AAU coach. And when the NCAA did investigate it, they found that Krzyzewski and the Duke people knew nothing about it at the time. But other than that, he's run as clean a program as you can imagine at the big-time level. He also, think about this, you're Mike Krzyzewski. You're in the Hall of Fame. You've won more games than any college coach in history. You've won 5 national championships, 12 Final Fours, the 3 Olympic gold medals, all that. Why in the hell would you put your entire reputation on the line for one player, any player, any player? Remember, Zion Williamson was not the number one recruit in the country as a high school senior. R.J. Barrett was. It was only after people started seeing him on YouTube when Duke was on the summer tour after he had already signed to go to Duke, that people began to go, wow, this guy's special. So to me, this is just an agent wildly flailing at anybody and everybody because they lost a lot of money when Zion Williamson left. And because I know Mike Krzyzewski as I do, having known him since he was coaching at Army, I don't believe for one second, that he was involved in anything like the people are accusing. And I'll leave you with one last thought. Nike is supposedly in the middle of all this. Nike pays Krzyzewski. Nike also pays John Calipari. Nike also pays Roy Williams. All three of those schools recruited Zion Williamson. If you're Nike, why would you pick one, any of those three, and say, we want you to go there and not go to the other two? Then you have to deal with the other two. Because if Nike does that, it's certainly not going to stay a secret. The other two coaches are going to know. That would just be stupid business on the part of Nike, and I don't believe it happened.
The NFL is going to have a conversation this week about stacking some new incentives on top of the Rooney Rule. We'll ask John Feinstein his thoughts on those after we spell them out. Next.
Midday when Andy queued up by Ed Lee's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone.
Your head coaching or general manager jobs, I'm not thinking a jump of 6 spots or 10 spots or 16 spots in the third round is much of a carrot. You?
Couldn't agree with you more, Paul. If it was in the first round, maybe. But I think a team would be crazy to hire a coach or general manager, regardless of color, based on the fact that by hiring that guy, you're going to jump 6 or 10 spots, depending on whether it's a coach or a GM, in the third round a year later. I do think this, though. If you keep reading in the story, there are other parts to this. Insisting that in following the Rooney Rule, you have to bring in at least one outside candidate. As you well know, what a lot of teams have done to meet the Rooney Rule is they'll just interview an African-American assistant and say, okay, we've done it. You know, we're good. Now we'll go out and hire who we want to hire. I think insisting on more interviews for minority candidates for coordinator jobs, for quarterback coach jobs, I think that's all good. I think the most important thing in this, Paul, is you're right. It's not going to incentivize teams to hire minority coaches or GMs. And clearly, the Rooney Rule has been abused. I think the last coach who was hired as a result of it, head coach, was probably Mike Tomlin, who ironically, of course, was hired by the Steelers. But I do think it's good that the NFL is acknowledging that it's a problem. And as this rule goes forward, if it's expanded, tweaked, if it has an effect, which I think it might have more of an effect in terms of coordinator jobs than anything else, it'll probably be known as the Eric Bieniemy rule. Because I think it was Eric Bieniemy not getting hired this year when everybody in football agreed he should be front and center for a head coaching job coming off of Andy Reid's staff and being the coordinator for Patrick Mahomes, and he didn't get a job. I think that's what people might end up calling it. It's what I would end up calling it. And remember, those who make the excuse, well, he didn't call the plays for Andy Reid, neither did Matt Nagy and neither did Doug Peterson. And yet they're both NFL head coaches.
The most attractive thing here is really for the team that's losing the coach that would go somewhere for a better job. That team gets compensatory picks that it didn't have before. It's not a slight increase in the round. It's a new pick out of nowhere. So if your coach goes and gets a head coaching job or conceivably goes and gets a coordinator job with duties that he didn't have at your place, which is something they've screwed up in the past because they were manipulating these assistant head coaching jobs and these offensive coordinator jobs and all of that. Now you're incentivizing those teams to develop those guys to go get jobs and giving them a pick out of nowhere, but they're incentivized anyway. Who doesn't want their coach to get good?
Right. Well, and I agree with you on that. Here's the question though. Let's say you've developed a guy and he's advanced to become your quarterback coach. I'm talking hypothetically, of course. Do you want to push him out the door? If you think he's good, do you want to say, oh yeah, go and be a coordinator somewhere, go be a head coach somewhere, instead of being with us when we've worked for however many years to get you to the point where you're now this good a coach? I certainly wouldn't push a good coach out the door in order to get a compensatory pick. I do agree with you, though, that the compensatory pick, if I can speak English, is more of an incentive than moving up a few spots in the third round of the draft. I 100% agree with you.
Most coaches, and I know Mike Vrabel says this here, most coaches tend to say, I'm not going to hold the guy back. I wouldn't have wanted to have been held back. I've had people that didn't hold me back, and I'm not going to hold the guy back if he could advance his career. I also think, though, it might create, in a dreamland scenario, it might create more coaching movement than the league as a whole, the coaching fraternity as a whole wants, just because teams want some level of continuity because of these complicated systems, et cetera, and they don't want to be seeing a train of coaches leaving and moving and shuffling all the time, white, black, or whatever.
I think you're right about that, and I hear what Vrabel's saying, and I think in the case of most coaches, that's probably the case. But there is a difference, isn't there, between saying, if organization, if the Indianapolis Colts call the Titans about a coach and saying, yeah, the guy's very good, blah, blah, and flip side, picking up a phone when the Colts have an opening and saying, you need to look at this guy. There's a line there between I wouldn't hold him back and I would actively try to help him move.
Major difference.
John Feinstein joins us each Monday, but next Monday is Memorial Day. So, John, we'll catch up at some point next week, I'm sure.
I will look forward to it. You guys let me know when you need me, and I'll be there because I have a feeling I'll still have some free time next week.
Okay. We look forward to it. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Jonathan.
John Feinstein with us, Washington Post columnist. He joins us each Monday at 11:15.
Some more layers to stacking on top of the Rooney Rule that we should get into next.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue. This is 104.5 The Zone.